You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to shop Walmart Black Friday deals first? Walmart Plus members get early access to our hottest deals. Join now and get 50% off a one-year annual membership. Shop Black Friday deals first with Walmart Plus. See terms at walmartplus.com.
We all have plans in life. Maybe to take a cross-country road trip or simply get through this workout without any back pain. Whether our plans are big, small, spontaneous, or years in the making, good health helps us accomplish them. At Banner Health, we're here to provide more than healthcare. Whatever you're planning, wherever you're going, we're here to help you get there. Banner Health. Exhale.
The Amazon River is the biggest in the world, but you might have to see it to take that to heart.
When I look to my right, I know theoretically that I'm looking at a river, but when the mud actually stops and you can see the glimmer of water, it's just water all the way out to the horizon. This is the biggest river on Earth, but it's really hard to remember when you're looking at it that it's a river and not the sea.
And the Amazon isn't simply one river. It's a vast network of thousands of rivers and tributaries and the largest flow of fresh water on Earth. The rainforest is home to the most diverse collection of plant and animal species on the planet, many of which are still undiscovered. The area is also home to millions of people, including indigenous groups that have lived there for millennia and whose participation is key to preserving this vital ecosystem.
It's a place where you can find from a very small invertebrate to a group of humans that never interacted with the world as we know. And I think when we are immersed there, we can rethink our own existence.
I'm Molly Bentley, and this is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute. In this episode, we go to South America to reveal the threat to and the hope for the Amazon. This episode is Amazing Amazonia.
Nine AM, a little bit hard for me to see through the sweat running down into my eyes, but I'm gonna get on the boat for Macapá shortly.
When National Geographic reporter Cynthia Gorney traveled through Brazil for the most recent issue of the magazine, she was no stranger to its humidity or enchanting beauty. As a reporter for the Washington Post for 16 years, who served as its South American bureau chief for two of them, she lived in Buenos Aires, and she traveled extensively in the Amazon for an 8-part series for the Post. Well, when we heard she was returning to the Amazon to travel on the river, we asked if she wouldn't mind recording a few impressions of her journey, and she joins us now to give the highlights of her trip. Thank you for being here.
I'm really happy to be with you today, Molly.
Okay, tell us, what was your assignment for Nat Geo that took you to Brazil?
The National Geographic Society, which partners with the magazine, had made Amazonia one of its big projects for this period. We decided to assemble a whole magazine around the research work of a number of scientists, almost all of them from Amazonia countries in South America, who are working on different aspects of life and ecology along the full length and breadth of the river system. I spent time with three of those scientists, one in Peru, two in Brazil. It was among the most marvelous work I can remember having done in decades.
Why is it important to call it Amazonia? It is used in the National Geographic issue. It is the title of our program.
I had two reasons for feeling that Amazonia was the right term. The first was to distinguish the region from the river. People tend to say the Amazon, again, as you noted right up top, as though it were a river. And it's very important to think of it not as a river, but as a region that is greatly influenced by the world's largest river system, right? And the second, honestly, was to distinguish it from that ubiquitous online service that we all now use.
Goodness. Right? I honestly, I hadn't thought of that. Yes.
Yeah. No, but seriously, that was part of the reason that I felt it important. But really, my primary feeling about it was that, to me, Amazonia conveys what it is, which is a land, a region, a giant region.
Now, we're going to hear clips of you traveling in various places. Could you just give us an overview of the kind of travels? You had to go from point A to point B to point C. I mean, what did that itinerary look like? I had a feeling you were traveling all over.
Well, to get to where scientists are working in Amazonia, you have to do some pretty creative travel. In my situation, that involved going to a research station in the Peruvian cloud forest, which is, of course, part of Amazonia, even though it may not seem that way, and more time even in parts of Brazil, which generally meant going to cities. In this case, the city of Manaus, the biggest city in Amazonia, and the smaller, less known city of Macapá, near the mouth where it meets the coast, and in particular, a town called Vila Progresso, which means what it sounds like, Progress Village, a tiny community on a small island at the mouth of the Amazon River.
I do have to follow up on the idea of a cloud forest. Now, I think we all have a picture of what a cloud forest might look like. What was the Peruvian cloud forest that you visited?
It is mountainous, and it is what it sounds like. There are massive cloud formations that typically, for much of the day, lower onto the treetops, and occasionally will break up so you have blue sky. But most of the time when walking there, I felt kind of familiar. I felt as though I was walking on high trails of the mountain in coastal fog. Of course, you're a long way from the coast when you're in the mountains of Peru.
You know, I think that we are all aware that the Amazon is in trouble due to deforestation and climate change, but I get the sense that while we may have an appreciation of what we have to lose, we can't really take it in if we haven't been there.
It was hard for me to take it in, and I was there. The clip you played at the beginning, my amazement at the size of the water, was only a part of it. When you're flying over it, trying to get to one of these either regional or much smaller airports, the size of what's beneath you is staggering. It's that we're looking at an area that is the size roughly of the continental United States. I think the part that hits, at least that hit me most, was the enormity of the water. Because in any of the particular locales that you find yourself in, you're looking around and you may say, this is amazing. I've never seen a place quite like this. But it's a locale. You can put your head around its dimensions. It's not until you read the stats and look at the enormity of that water horizon in front of you that it starts to sink in just how complex and vast this place is.
Well, you mentioned water, and one thing that is clear from my understanding of your reporting is that if you're going to study the Amazon, you have to figure out how to get around it, and that means preparing to travel by river. And in fact, much of this episode, at least, is at river level, but those rivers are key for transportation, aren't they?
The river system, to an extent that I had not appreciated even in my previous travels there, is the highway system for much of Amazonia. There are roads, for sure. And of course, there are big cities, and the big cities have roads and bus systems and taxis and all of that. But in between, the main form of transport for all but the mountain regions is by boat. I'm sitting near the end of a long dock that goes out into what I know is the Amazon River, except that what I'm looking at is a giant flat of dark brown mud. I'm not talking about like muddy water. This is mud thick enough to stand up on. They've told me that the guys here sometimes play soccer on this mud. And this is the mud of low tide. To my left is a three-decker Amazon boat, the kind that delivers people and goods to the islands and small communities up and down the river. And the first time I saw one of these boats when I got to Macapá,
I couldn't imagine how it could possibly ever move because it was clearly completely mudbound, like it had been hauled on by chains or a truck or something. And I asked people who were nearby, is that boat stuck? How is it going to take off? And they laughed and said, come back tonight. And when I came back at night, the boat was full of people preparing to leave, and the tide had risen, I don't know, 15 or 20 feet, and the boat now was floating.
Cynthia, where on the river were you where the tides were 15 feet? And those aren't river tides, right? Because rivers don't have tides. I mean, so you must have been close to the Atlantic?
Well, there's a couple of things about that, Molly. First of all, we were somewhat close to the Atlantic in the sense that this was the city, really, of Macapa. It's more than a million people when you get out into the outer regions of the town. Macapa is very much on the river, and the word tides doesn't have quite the same meaning that you and I think, because the river does rise and fall by 15 feet in certain parts of Amazonia. The tides that are coming into Macapa are coming in from the sea, but they're also the river tides.
The tides are different than seasonal flooding, right? The seasonal flooding actually puts part of the rainforest underwater. What is the difference?
The difference really is rain, right? In a normal year, which, let us be clear, Amazonia has not had for the last couple of years, which is important. In a normal year, in much of the central part of Amazonia, the rains, which go on for months, are so profound that they will raise the water level 15 feet, depths that would be catastrophic if they were in most parts of the world. But because that is expected, the houses are built to accommodate it. People plan their travel and their departures from their homes based on the rise and fall of that water.
Now, it was my understanding, well, from the magazine, that the rise and the fall of the rivers, but also the seasonal rains, can drown, although that's not quite the right word, but just cover the forested terrain. So you have to have plants and trees that can survive both submerged and then also without the water.
It's funny, Molly, I use the word drown because they did. But I was thinking, for us, drowning implies death, right? There, it does not. It implies renewal of life because the plant life, the animal life, and the non-animal, the human life, all revolve around this seasonal flooding. I had a hard time getting accustomed to an image that kept being raised for me by the scientists, which is, see those branches? Part of the year, those branches have fish swimming through them, and part of the year, they have birds sitting on top of them.
Could you give us a sense of the amount of water that the Amazon River and its tributaries moves around?
I can give you some data points. For example, the discharge of fresh water from the Amazon out into the Atlantic is greater than the next seven great rivers of the world combined. All right. So if you think about the discharge of any great rivers that you've heard of, the Mississippi, the Nile, et cetera, add all those up, it's not as much as the water that comes out of the Amazon. If you can imagine water rushing into an Olympic-sized swimming pool, the water that is discharged from the Amazon into the Atlantic could fill 83 Olympic-sized swimming pools per second.
Amazing.
Kind of a weird image, but it's another way to try to get your head around the enormity of the water being carried by that river system.
Well, you continued your journey on the water from Villa Progresso, which was on the archipelago, to Macapa, and you're about to get into a boat. You're going to be on it for a long time. What does one do to prepare to get on a boat and travel on the Amazon?
If the situation had been normal, what I probably would have done is gone to the little sort of restaurant grocery store and gotten myself various things to eat and drink on the boat. This is a very simple boat. There's no cafe. In my case, I had actually been incredibly sick for 3 days, some kind of very non-exotic, just food poisoning. And I had been living basically on the water and Coca-Cola diet for 3 days straight. So I had a lot of water and a lot of Coca-Cola in my bag. And bear in mind that very long journeys like this on the water are a fact of life in this part of the world. And you don't know, as everybody understands, exactly how long the journey is going to be. The river may hang you up. There may be a sudden rain pour. The mud under the river may just stop your boat for a couple of hours at a time. So people are not on a close timetable at all. And a journey of some hours may turn out to be some hours longer than that. And everybody gets that.
Sounds like the big engine of the boat. Tide is rising. Last four guys are getting in. Hammocks are set. Bananas have been brought on board. We're pushing off. A warm breeze is blowing across the river. The tide has come way up. And the deck where my tiny cabin is now full of nets. And one of the styrofoam containers just got opened up, and it's full of shrimp. Shrimp in ice that is somehow supposed to keep these shrimp cold for the next, I think, 10 hours.
Cynthia, did it keep the shrimp cold for 10 hours? And 10 hours, when you said a few hours, I was thinking a couple hours. That's a long time
to
be on
a
boat.
Well, in fact, you recall me saying that you can't predict how long these boats are going to be. In fact, it was more like 12 hours. And
oh,
they
goodness.
Took an hour and a half to kind of get going. So it was a very long trip.
But what's happening that you're traveling with bananas and shrimp? Is that food for the travelers?
No. The boats like this are typically used for a number of purposes at the same time. There are people going back and forth from the villages to the cities, either to visit family or to engage in commerce, to sell items that they have gathered or grown or caught in the communities. And so everybody gets it that these boats are carrying both freight and people.
You've been to the Amazon many times. I'm wondering if there was anything on these most recent trips that was new to you, anything that was revealed to you.
The main thing that surprised me that felt new to me was the extent of urban life in the Amazonian cities, Manaus, Macapá, the two largest ones that I was able to see. There were certainly cities in the Amazon when I was there 40 years ago, and indeed, new archaeological research is showing us that there have been cities for millennia in Amazonia, but I was not really prepared for the full urban life that I saw in parts of Macapá and Manaus, the street markets, the taxis, the skyscrapers, the high-rise apartment buildings for people who have moved to Amazonia.
So actually quite urban.
Yes.
Parts of it are quite urban.
And the other thing that surprised me, honestly, paradoxically, was the extent to which it felt like things had not changed. When I went to the docks in Manaus, which I had a pretty vivid memory of from our previous time there, it felt to me as though neither the docks nor the actual boats had changed at all. I recall sending my husband a couple of photographs of boats that we were watching and saying, I think we were on this actual boat, you know, in 1981. So it was a combination of the way things have changed and the way things have not that I think struck me the most.
Part of this overwhelming complexity of Amazonia is that it includes these modern cities, but it also includes tiny towns like the one you visited, Villa Progresso. Let's listen.
What's right around me is a small mercantile store. One solar panel. Solar panels are the way that people have at least a little bit of light when the electricity goes out for hours or days, or in some cases, weeks at a time here. People walking quietly back and forth. It's really dark except for the few lights over the houses, and it's really hot and it's really steamy.
And Cynthia, that metallic sound in the background, those are insects?
It's insects.
Those are insects. Okay. Not like insects I've ever heard, but...
No, but let's remember one of the other stats about Amazonia is that it has one-tenth of all the insect and animal life on the planet. I can't give you a good insect stat, but I know that there are 10,000 different species of beetle, just beetles, that have been found in Amazonia.
It's about 8 o'clock in the evening at the side of the wooden boardwalk that constitutes the main street of a mouth of the Amazon community called Villa Progreso, which is one of about a dozen communities that are scattered around seven islands out here at the place where the great freshwater Amazon River meets the sea. To get here, the two scientists that I'm working with and I spent 6 hours in a motorboat slamming against the waves of what scientists call the plume, which is an astounding phenomenon. The experience of it I can best describe as, imagine that you're in a boat zooming along a surface that keeps striating between kind of cappuccino color and blue-green and then cappuccino color again. You can almost see the lines in the water.
Cynthia, could you say more about how those striations were created? You did describe them, but I'm still having trouble picturing, you know, sort of how they're created at the mouth of the river.
Imagine that you've got a tray into which you pour three different colors of paint that are swirling around each other before mixing. That's really what it looks like. What's happening in the water is the river water is so filled with silt and accumulated material from the full length of the multiple rivers that it won't mix with the salt water. And the salt water is so powerful coming in from the Atlantic that rather than blending, it's kind of like interlocking fingers or something. They striate like this, as I said. And one of the things that I didn't mention in that clip that's the most fascinating about this body that they call the plume is that, in a certain sense, the Amazon River pushes all the way up into the Caribbean. There is a body of silt-filled fresh water that is so powerful and so heavy that you can find traces of it on the Caribbean islands. It's a function of the tremendous power of that water that's pouring out of the Amazon.
Well, Cynthia, we've heard about your trips on the Amazon River, and later in the show we'll hear about a historic river journey taken a century ago. And that story comes from another seasoned Amazon reporter, Larry Roeder, and I understand that you know Larry.
Larry and my husband and I were friends way back in the day when we were all reporters working in different parts of South America. And it was lovely to hear from him again through you.
We've gotten a sense of what it's like to travel on one of the rivers. Here is Larry Roeder's impression of entering the rainforest.
You've got light dappling from above, and the trees are 100, 150 feet high. So it's coming in. You've got all this wildlife on the ground. There's multitudes of different Amazon environments. You know, here you're going to see a sloth. You know, here you're going to see an anteater. My favorite thing, I think, always has been the butterflies, which have such brilliant colors, the blues and the yellows especially. And the birds, you know, and how noisy they are and how beautiful.
You call it noise. They call it conversation.
Yes.
Music.
It is in a way. It's quite charming. And the monkeys as well, sometimes even throwing stuff at you.
Have you had monkeys throw things at you?
Not in Brazil. I've had Indian monkeys throw things at me, but that's a different story.
Goodness. I had to be more specific. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to add to his description of the rainforest, what it's like to be there?
One of the things that I remember most vividly, now that you ask me, was the scientist, Angelo Bernardino, that I spent time with in the archipelago. His specialty is mangroves. And he wanted to show me a certain kind of mangrove that they discovered grows in Amazonia in different conditions than perhaps anywhere else on Earth. Not quite as salty water, a combination of the salty and fresh water. And so we had to dock the boat in a place that no human could possibly dock a boat. It was like you couldn't even find a dock space there, the little boat. And then we climb out. And then Angelo is like talking so excitedly about this mangrove. And I'm, of course, trying to take notes and climb over these enormous roots. It's like Anybody who's ever been near a mangrove, it's like the world's most massive, crazy root system, right? And the roots are up above your head and at your waist.
Wait, what do you mean the roots are above your head?
Okay, if you've ever seen a mangrove, anybody who's ever seen, and mangrove is a complicated word. It describes a whole family of plants that grow in saline conditions along coasts. And one of the things that makes them both special and an important part of the ecology of the coasts is that they have these enormous complex root systems that go down into the mud, out into the water, and also kind of up into the air. The roots hold carbon, which is part of the reason they're so important for the environment. They also provide homes and nurseries for fish and other kinds of animals that live out there. And they also make an amazing jungle gym if you're a reporter who hasn't eaten anything for 3 days trying to follow an excited scientist and take notes. So that was my primary recent experience of being in rainforest-like climate, except we're out in a real tidal community.
If you think traveling on the Amazon is challenging today, imagine doing it a century ago. Next, the expeditions of a Brazilian military officer and scientist who navigated the river with Teddy Roosevelt.
This expedition has been written about a lot, but almost always from Roosevelt's point of view. And Americans tend to think of him as the leader of the expedition. At best, he was the co-leader.
And among other things, piranhas make an appearance as our journey through amazing Amazonia continues on Big Picture Science.
Want to shop Walmart Black Friday deals first? Walmart Plus members get early access to our hottest deals. Join now and get 50% off a one-year annual membership. Shop Black Friday deals first with Walmart Plus. See terms at walmartplus.com.
My name is Larry Roeder. I'm a journalist who has been covering the Amazon since 1978, first for Newsweek magazine, then for the New York Times, and I'm the author of the biography Into the Amazon, The Life of Cândido Rondon. Cândido Rondon was the greatest explorer of the Amazon, and he was a native of the Amazon and of indigenous descent and became a wonderful scientist as well.
The subtitle of Larry Roeder's book about Cândido Rondon is Trailblazing Explorer, Scientist, Statesman, and Conservationist. Born in the mid-19th century, he studied math and astronomy before he undertook a trajectory that made him the Lewis and Clark of Brazil, which is impressive. National Geographic reporter Cynthia Gorney continues to provide perspective for us about the Amazon. Cynthia, why is Cândido Rondon an important figure as we consider the past and future of Amazonia?
Cândido Rondon is an astonishing figure, and Larry did Brazil and the world, I think, an amazing service by writing this fascinating biography, which taught me so much more about Rondon than I had ever known. One, of course, runs into his name and his presence in Brazil. There's a giant region named after him, which was the case when we were there a long time ago. I remember being in the communities of Rondônia, right? But his name is really not known, I don't think, certainly not in the U.S. And he's an astonishment. The number of circles that his life touches in Brazil and the trajectory that he makes, the influence he has, and the way he sets a certain model, which of course was not exclusively followed, unfortunately, at all, but remains an important part of the way the indigenous people can and should be treated in Brazil, which is to say with respect for their own way of life, their own culture.
Cândido Rondon grew up in grinding poverty. His father died before he was born, and his mother died of smallpox when he was two. His mixed ethnic heritage, including that of indigenous descent, would prove an asset when he took an assignment to help connect Brazil with the rest of the world by stringing a telegraph line, as Larry Roeder is about to describe. At the time, much of Brazil was wild, unmapped, and unknown to the outside world.
Larry, Candido Rondon was born in 1865 in the region of Mato Grosso in central Brazil. He grew up speaking Portuguese and among indigenous people. From them, he learned to hunt and track wildlife, for example. What kind of education and ethos did his early years provide him?
Well, the ethos is the most important, which was one of respecting nature, trying to learn its secrets, and imbibing from the indigenous peoples around him, who were his relatives, a way of looking at the world in which nature was not an enemy but an ally.
And he learned actual skills of tracking wildlife, understanding the jungle, how to survive in the jungle.
Absolutely. You know, what could be, what was safe to eat, what wasn't, how to hunt, how to track, how to fish, all the skills that were important and necessary to his later career as a professional explorer. Yeah.
Now, you talk about him laying this telegraph line, and I think in the end he lay about 4,000 miles into the Amazon. Could you give us a clear idea of why this was important over 100 years ago? And also, where do you lay telegraph line?
Yeah.
Is it above? Is it below?
Yeah,
is
always
it
above.
Under the snakes? And yeah. Do the snakes? I mean, it seems like there's a lot there to consider.
He would have his men cut down trees. They brought a supply of these arms to go on it. And the wire then, they would put the stakes in, and then the wire would connect them over hundreds and then well over 1,000 miles from start to finish. Yeah, the importance of the telegraph line to the making of a modern Brazilian republic, I think, can be compared to the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. It united disparate parts of a continental-sized nation. And with it, you were able to bring these previously remote and uncontacted areas into the nation. I would emphasize, however, that the way Rondon did things was very different from the way that the U.S. cavalry did things or the railroad builders, because he was, of course, of indigenous descent himself, and he was also a pacifist. I mean, the remarkable thing that he did, the most remarkable of many remarkable things, I think, is that he would always go in unarmed, meet with the leadership of the people whose territory this line was going to cross, and make them his allies to the point that many times these groups participated in the construction of the actual telegraph line, because Rondon told them, after this is finished, you will be its guardians and you will have control of the telegraph stations, and I will train the young men that you designate to be telegraph operators. So it was an ethos of cooperation and pacifism instead of military conflict.
And there's a story of him bringing a Victrola, that is a phonograph.
Yeah.
The jungle to play music? Caruso?
Yes.
Caruso Records? Is it?
Yeah, among other things. I mean,
okay, if you heard that, you would think that was apocryphal. Can you just tell
us
that story?
Yeah, this is a trope that you've seen, like, in Werner Herzog's Fitzcarraldo.
yes, it is.
But it really happened with Rondon. He brought these records because he wanted to impress indigenous peoples not only with the scientific knowledge and might of Brazilian European-style civilization, but also with the culture. And music is universal. It's a way of impressing the indigenous peoples.
And how did they respond to it?
It depended from group to group. Some embraced it. Others were frightened by it. Others were awed by it. But it always had an impact. And then in a subsequent stage, he flipped the script and he brought recording equipment to record the music of indigenous tribes that he was working with.
Now, I wonder if you could give us a full immersion description of what it would have been like to walk through the jungle and travel down the Amazon River 100 years ago. What would that have been like? Because the Amazon, of course, is beautiful. It's rich in diversity, but it is an unforgiving place
it
as
is.
Well.
So
take
even
us
today.
And even today. Take
Much
us,
more so then.
Take us there.
Because at the time Rondon was working, you know, we're talking about 1890 to 1930, there were no established highways or even pathways. He was opening the jungle without trying to destroy it, you know, a pathway that his men could then follow. But once you got out of that cleared area or when you were moving into new territory, you were constantly on the lookout for these challenges and dangers, whether they be disease, from beriberi to malaria, whether they be wild animals, from very tiny scorpions to large boa constrictors. You just never could let your guard down. And men signed on with Rondon for a sense of adventure, but knowing that they faced these life-ending threats. And men did die. And Rondon himself was hit with arrows.
Poison arrows, I believe.
Poison arrows.
Not just any arrow.
No.
That would be bad enough.
No. But he did nothing, you know, to seek revenge. And eventually the people who did that, the Nambiquara, became among his staunchest allies.
But 100 years ago, certainly, and today, you don't go into the jungle unprepared and you don't go down the river unprepared. And
no.
He was the consummate...
Meticulous.
Yes. Explorer in that way. And that was why he survived.
Yeah. Rondon always had with him at least one doctor on an expedition. And these guys were top notch. But we're talking about, let's say, 1910, 1915. And you don't have antibiotics. You have quinine for, you know, malaria. But sometimes that could be as bad as the cure could be as bad as the disease itself. So infections, absolutely. But that was typical of the kind of thing. You get a little cut and, you know, the next thing you know, it's all puffed up and you're going to lose your leg.
While he's in the jungle and he's laying the telegraph line, he's also creating a catalog of
Absolutely.
The plants and the animals. Can
Absolutely.
You tell us a little bit about that? What did he catalog, perhaps for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, his own specialty, he was interested in everything. He really was a polymath. But he did bring experts along. So you had zoologists, you had ichthyologists, you had herpetologists, you had geologists. He was interested in all those things, but he deferred to the experts. You know, his particular area of interest, I would say, became linguistics, you know, indigenous languages, and anthropology or ethnology. You know, there wasn't really a distinction between the two at the time. And he wrote lots of papers. The commission that he headed published over 100 scientific papers, some of which, you know, are still cited today. And in fact, if you've read anything by Levi-Strauss, if you look at the footnotes, you'll see that he often cites Rondon's papers, especially in a book like, you know, Tristi Tropiques, where he was essentially revisiting places that Rondon and his men had been first.
Before we go on, is it true that one of the men on the Rondon expedition met his grisly fate in a school of piranhas?
Yeah.
That's so Rondon, casually. What
Rondon
happened?
Was building a telegraph line across the Pantanal, which today is one of the largest eco-tourism areas in the entire world, but then was just this massive swamp. And it was very slow going. And one of his advanced scouts, who was a young officer very close to him, fell off of his donkey and was, in fact, consumed by piranhas, except that he was wearing leather boots and somehow those survived with his feet in them.
Do piranhas eat everything?
Depends on the time of year, to tell you the truth. You know, in the rainy season, no. I mean, I've actually been swimming in swimming holes where piranhas are there. And they don't bother you in the rainy season. But when the dry season comes and they're, you know, in cramped space, then yes, they're just absolutely voracious.
Okay, well, this is the environment in which the 1914 Roosevelt expedition unfolds. In 1914, Rondon led a joint American-Brazil expedition up a mysterious river that Candon himself had discovered. It was one that was a tributary of the Amazon River.
Right.
That was thought to be as long as 1,000 kilometers, and he had named it the River of Doubt.
Because he didn't know where it really started or where it would end. And that was in 1909. He said, I got to come back here. And the opportunity came with Roosevelt in December of 1913 all the way through to April of 1914.
So he brings on this expedition the ex-president at that time,
right.
Theodore Roosevelt.
And two naturalists from the American Museum of Natural History.
Okay. And I think Roosevelt's son.
And Roosevelt's son, Kermit, yeah.
Kermit. Before we talk about what happened, can you give us a sense, Larry, of how much of the Amazon River had been mapped in 1914?
The main river had been mapped, as had some of the principal tributaries, the Madeira and the Rio Negro among them. Now, the River of Doubt, it was discovered, flowed into the Madeira. So the River of Doubt turns out to be the largest tributary of the largest tributary of the Amazon. And they thought it was going to be 1,000 kilometers long. It's actually 1,400, 1,500 kilometers long.
I wonder if you could give us an overview of how the two teams embarked on this expedition. So you have Rondon's team, and their attitude toward the jungle and his attitude were quite different, and the goals were different from the Roosevelt team.
Yeah, I would say that the Americans wanted to capture as many new species of animals as possible in the shortest amount of time.
Capture and bring them home?
Capture and bring them home to the American Museum of Natural History. Rondon, on the other hand, trained as a cartographer, wanted to map every foot of that river so that future users and navigators would know exactly what it was like. He wanted to accumulate knowledge thoroughly and reliably and publish these papers that then would be available to not just to Brazilians, but to all of mankind. So the two kind of styles or approaches clashed.
Okay, this is going to be a challenge for you because we want to summarize a 5-month trip that had a lot of drama in it.
Yeah.
But it is challenging because this was a 5-month trip with lots of peril, real disaster, death in some cases, some near calamities. Can you give us an overview of what this trip required and why Candon was an invaluable leader of this trip?
Yeah, it required above all stamina and cooperation. You know, Rondon and Roosevelt worked together pretty well, considering the pressures they were under. First couple of months are overland. Then they get, at the end of February 1914, to the source of the River of Doubt, and then they begin their descent.
And that was not trivial. They went over 400 miles of land through the jungle.
Oh, more than that.
Okay,
yeah.
More than that.
Yeah.
All my estimations of distance have been off. But anyway, so it's not like you're just dropped at mouth of the river.
Uh-uh. You got to get there.
Right, you have to get there.
And
that was
some
perilous.
Of that was unexplored land as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the river, and then the real hard stuff begins. And there were 22 men, and 4 of them were Americans, 18 Brazilians. And it took them exactly 2 months to descend the river. They ran out of food. They got sick, malaria and other things. Just incredibly harsh terrain where there's these waterfalls and
waterfalls, like a series of rapids.
Oh, for weeks on end. And you would have to then portage up onto the land and then haul your canoes. Originally, there were 7. Some got destroyed in rapids. Others broke open when you're lowering them from up above back onto the river.
And when you say you have to portage, it was really Rondon and his men that were doing the portaging, was it not?
Yeah.
And Roosevelt and his men were coming along, but it was
right.
The Brazilians were the ones that understood the jungle. And they understood.
They had the local knowledge.
They had the local knowledge.
Right. They may not have been able to read, but they knew how to read the weather. They knew how to read tracks. They just had this encyclopedic knowledge of the Amazon and the interior of the country.
Any supplies? I mean, it can't just be knowledge, everything you know, that's between your ears?
Sure. I mean, you know, you take supplies with you, but you don't take tons and tons because you know that when you get deep, deep in, you can find things that you can eat, whether it's hearts of palm, you know, whether it's certain types of birds, monkeys. You know, whatever is there, you learn to adapt your diet to what's available. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book was that this expedition has been written about a lot, but almost always from Roosevelt's point of view. And Americans tend to think of him as the leader of the expedition. At best, he was the co-leader. More often than not, he deferred to Rondon and Rondon's men precisely because they had this local knowledge. They had 25 years of doing this in other areas of the Amazon.
Can we give one precise example, which is that I believe that Rondon's men and Rondon himself were surprised that the Americans wanted to bring their canoes. I mean, never mind that they were bringing just crates and crates of food and wine and all of this other stuff that was not necessary for the expedition.
Yeah.
But they wanted to bring canoes, whereas the Brazilians thought, no, you just make the canoes as you go along.
Right. Yeah, these differences of style and approach really, to me, are one of the main markers of this unusual expedition. The way the Brazilians went about doing things was more living off the land, adapting to the land. The American way of doing things was more challenge the land. We'll overcome the nature, the natural barriers. You know, each thought the other's way was, you know, I don't know about this.
But
in the end, Roosevelt almost always, not always, but almost always deferred to Rondon.
How long does it take to build a canoe in the jungle? Or how long did it take 100 years ago to build a canoe on the spot in the jungle?
Yeah, with these guys, once you've chosen the wood, and Rondon always would go with him and say this, this, and this, because he knows what kind of trees are the best. It would take them 2 or 3 days. I mean, you've got 16 paddlers, so you know, working in teams from let's say 8 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, they made rapid progress, and they had to do that multiple times, build new canoes.
By the end of the 5-month trip, Roosevelt was in bad shape. He was battling an infected leg wound and malaria, and we could say he was clinging to life. And is it fair to say that without Rondon, Roosevelt would not have survived this trip?
I think so. And Roosevelt, when he got back home, was generous in his praise, especially for Dr. Cajazeira, who was the expedition physician, and twice operated on Roosevelt during the descent of the river.
And that's where Roosevelt had sustained his injury to his leg.
Yeah, an injury to his leg that then, it got gangrenous.
And you can only imagine the bacteria that...
Absolutely,
went into the wound.
You know, he had the malaria, he had heart palpitations, he was really... Dr. Cajazeira saw what was happening. He had some medicines, but not everything he needed. But he did the best he could and took zealous care of Roosevelt. Roosevelt probably lost 60 pounds on this excursion, if you want to call it that.
His health never recovered.
No, he never did.
But Rondon was fine. He didn't even get malaria on this trip.
I mean, Rondon, he's this little guy. He's 5'3". If he weighs 120, it's soaking wet. He's, a bantam kind of guy, but he's tough as nails. I mean, he just goes through these experiences and comes out unscathed. And he lived to be 93, almost 93.
In the end, how much jungle, how much land, and how much river had they crossed? I mean, what was the summary of the amount of distance that they traveled?
Yeah, I think, from where Roosevelt met Rondon on the Brazilian border with Paraguay to Manaus is well over 2,000 miles on land and on water. And the River of Doubt turns out to be nearly 1,000 miles, not 1,000 kilometers, but nearly 1,000 miles long. So that when Roosevelt and Rondon submitted their geographic papers, there were people in, especially in the UK, in London, who were scoffing, saying, this is impossible.
They didn't believe him.
They didn't believe him.
They didn't believe that he had made this trip?
Nope. They didn't believe that Roosevelt had made this trip. They believed that Rondon had taken him down a different river. There was just this unwillingness to believe that this little Indian guy could be a better explorer of the tropics than all the big names that were members of the Royal Geographical Society.
But something turned them around, because in the end, they did celebrate the expedition and Roosevelt got a medal for
right.
it. And what turned them around? When did they believe that this had happened?
Roosevelt went over to England and he gave a presentation. And the evidence was so convincing that people threw in the towel. They said, okay, you're right. But the credit went in England. The credit went to Roosevelt alone. It was as if Rondon wasn't even there.
But I thought he wanted to share his medal with
yes.
Rondon.
Yes. Roosevelt's conduct was impeccable. He repeatedly said, I'm just putting the cherry on top of all this work that Colonel Rondon has done over the last quarter of a century. And he did that at the National Geographic Society meeting in Washington, D.C. He did it in New York, where, in fact, the Explorers Club awarded Rondon the same medal that a couple years earlier it had given to Roosevelt.
Well, Candido Rondon lived a long life. He died at the age of 93, I believe, in 1958. And at that time, he was a hero of Brazil. Among his accomplishments is that he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Three times
for his work with indigenous tribes. How is he regarded in Brazil today, and what is his legacy?
His legacy is enormous and alive. He's a national hero. He's the only Brazilian who has a state named for him.
Rondônia,
absolutely. And his philosophy of nonviolence and his philosophy of working with indigenous peoples and creating a national park system has become a political tool that defenders of the Amazon make use of even today. And during the 4 years of Bolsonaro, Rondon's legacy as a pacifist and as a scientist was repeatedly cited as another path that we could take instead of the one that Bolsonaro is offering. Now you've got Lula back.
And what is that path?
Pardon me?
Just to be clear what that path is that Bolsonaro was offering.
Well, I mean, he wanted instant development, opening the Amazon, letting mining companies and loggers and ranchers run roughshod over the area and not giving any more land to the Indians and forcibly integrating them into Brazilian society if necessary.
Whereas Rondon was stressing the importance of working with indigenous groups to preserve the land.
To preserve the land and letting them decide for themselves to what degree, if any, they wanted to have contact and integration with larger Brazilian society mm-hmm. and respecting the choices they made.
And it's not just a humanist approach. It is actually more practical.
It is.
To work with the people of the land to preserve the land.
Yes. I mean, it would seem to be obvious, right? But not to some.
Larry Roeder is a journalist. He's a former South American bureau chief based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, for the New York Times from 1999 to 2007. And he is the author of Into the Amazon, The Life of Candido Rondon, Trailblazing Explorer, Scientist, Statesman, and Conservationist. Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a new generation of conservationists continues the work of Candido Rondon by partnering with indigenous people who have long called Amazonia home.
12,000 years living in the Amazon is not about only like a deep relationship with the nature, but also about production of social technology. They know how to manage the environment.
This is Amazing Amazonia on Big Picture Science. Oh,
This episode is brought to you by United Airlines. When you want to make the most of your vacation, book with United. They're an airline that cares about your travels as much as you do. United is transforming the flying experience with Bluetooth connectivity, screens, power at every seat, and bigger overhead bins to help fit everyone's bag. And with their app, you can skip the bag check line, get live updates, and more. Change the way you fly. Book your next trip today at united.com.
The Amazon is a story of an ecosystem under dire threat because of deforestation and climate change, but it is also a story of hope. Candido Rondon recognized that the deep human history of the area, over nearly 13,000 years, is where the stewardship for a modern Amazonia is found. That ethos is being echoed by young conservationists today. João Campos Silva is a Brazilian researcher whose story is part of the Amazon issue of National Geographic. And you spoke with him, Cynthia. What did you learn? What is he working on?
First of all, João is an amazing character. He's one of those people who fills a room with joy when he opens his mouth. He's a wonderful musician. Part of the time I spent with him was in a recording studio as he recorded one of the new songs he's written about the spirit of Amazonia. He is passionate about the role that the ribeirinhos, is a river people, his word, need to play in decisions that will be made about the future of Amazonia. He wrote his graduate thesis about a giant prehistoric fish called the arapaima, which in Brazil is also known as the pirarucu, which is the largest scaled freshwater fish on the planet. But really what he was studying was the way that the local people of communities in the area that he was working, we're talking now about the floodplain in the sort of central part of Brazil, created their own fishing rules to bring back the almost extinct arapaima. It was a fishing compact, which is not something, of course, that they invented. We've heard of these in off the coast of Maine and so on to save fish species. But the important thing about this fish compact was that with the approval of the government, it was agreed to, designed, and maintained by the ribeirinhos, by the people who actually live there.
Well, we all like a success story, and João has one, a fish story that is not far-fetched. He says the model for a sustainable Amazonia is found in that 10-foot fish with scales like armor. João, there's a photo of you on the National Geographic website, and you are standing in a river up to your chest, and you're holding an enormous fish. The fish is so big that you can't see the head of it or the tail of it in this photograph. And I'm assuming that this is the arapaima. Am I correct in that? Is that the fish you're holding?
Yeah.
What is it like to hold that fish? My goodness.
Yes, this is the arapaima, or pirarucu, as we call in Brazil. It can reach up to 200 kilos and almost 3 meters. And due to its huge importance, it was overfished over the last century. Mm-hmm. So the population was reduced in many places in the Amazon.
Well, I recommend anyone to look up this photo or a photo of this fish because they're really magnificent. I want to hear more. I think we'd love to hear more about what it's like to travel down the Amazon River or its tributaries and visit some of these river communities.
I arrived in Amazonia 17 years ago. And those immersion with local people was super important to me to show me another paradigm in terms of conservation science. For those people, conservation is a way of life because 12,000 years living in the Amazon is not about only like a deep relationship with the nature, but also about production of social technology. They know how to manage the environment. Yeah, but I think that the most impactful feeling paddling a boat in the Amazon is to reconnect our time perception with the time of the nature. And this is super interesting for me because Amazonia perhaps is one of the last big frontier of the human knowledge. It's a place where you can find from a very small invertebrate to a group of humans that never interacted with the world as we know. And I think when we are immersed there, we can imagine new pathways and rethink our own existence.
Well, let's go into solutions then. Can you describe for us what has worked? What approach have indigenous groups used that have helped protect the Pirarucu?
First, basically, local communities are empowered to protect their territories and the Pirarucu habitat. So they can build like wooden house in the entrance of the lakes, and then they can monopolize the fish stocks, avoiding illegal fishers and commercial fishers to enter in the lake.
It's a very simple intervention, but it's a way to monitor the fish year-round. Is that right?
Exactly. You can monitor the fish, but also the invasion from poachers or illegal fishers. So the local surveillance take turns in those wooden houses, you know, so they can protect the environment 24/7 during the entire year. And then you have like the protected territory, and then you can count the number of fish in the lake. So at the end, you can send a report for the government, and the government can allow you to harvest a fishing quota, because outside this model, the Pirarucu fisheries is forbidden.
What's important about what you're saying, a few things. One is that it hasn't been outsiders or conservationists coming in. It's the people who depend on these fish that have instigated the conservation efforts.
Exactly, Molly, you got the point. This is the first very important initial thing. This is an effort conducted by local people. And this process is super cool because it's generated lots of social and environmental outcomes. For example, the Pirarucu population has been increasing a lot. It was recovered by 425% over the last 12 years.
It's come back 420% in the last 12 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
And when you protect the lakes, you are not only protecting the Pirarucu, but many other species.
Mm-hmm. It's all connected. It's all
exactly.
Connected. And I've seen videos of you measuring those little turtles, those freshwater turtles. They're really cute, but with a great big smile on your face, because you're probably very happy to see them and see the other species thriving.
Yeah, it's super interesting because the protected lakes works as a biodiversity island. You know, you see many, many species, caiman, black caimans, river dolphins, freshwater turtles, many other species of fish.
Well, Joao, it sounds like this is a positive, encouraging story of conservation coming out of Amazonia, where we usually think of the precious biodiversity being lost, that we're in danger of losing it all. Is the tide turning? Are we starting to see some, can we now feel some optimism about what's happening in Amazonia?
Yeah, this is a good question. The conservation science are always immersed in a doom and gloom narratives. And the optimism is one of the most important ingredients to think a brighter future, not only Amazonia, because optimism is not like a naive point of view, but it's like a survival strategy. And we need to spotlight strategies that are succeeding, you know, so people, especially the young conservationists, young researchers, can see clear examples where another world is possible. And this is very, very important in my opinion. But there are lots of challenges. And one big challenge is the price of the managed pirarucu is still not fair enough.
The market price, you mean?
The market price,
yeah.
The market do not pay properly.
So it needs to be sustainable economically. It's not just about biodiversity, sustainability of the land. You also have to make sure that people can make a fair living.
Exactly. And this occurs because local communities has a huge effort to protect the territory. It increased the production cost of the fish. So we need to develop a payment for environmental service to recognize and reward this huge effort made by local communities to protect their territory, because we already know that there is no strategy more efficient than the community-led protection of the Amazon forest. But we need to find a pathway to better reward those local efforts.
Well, João Campos Silva, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks. It was my pleasure, Molly. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
João Campos Silva is a Brazilian researcher and conservationist and co-founder of the conservation organization Instituto Juruá, that is trying to develop partnerships with local communities and grassroots organizations in Amazonia. His work, along with that of other conservationists, is featured in the National Geographic issue devoted to the Amazon. Well, as we come to the big picture perspective of this episode, Cynthia, I'm going to throw a big picture question at you. What does saving the Amazon mean?
The biggest thing to remember is how many things it means. It means, I think, both specific sets of multinational agreements aimed at protecting the forests, which is the first thing that we think of, because of the forest's profound importance to the climate of the planet. It also means understanding how much human life exists in the Amazon and will continue to exist, and how complicated it is going to be to keep that life healthy and strong while doing the larger work.
So the idea is you can't take humans out of the equation.
Absolutely not. And I think it also means making some very large and difficult economic and political decisions about what we will prioritize. Because many of the giant destructive decisions of the Amazon have been made because taking these resources out is very profitable for many countries and many private companies. And these companies and countries are providing things that people want and perhaps need, but you can't talk about, quote, saving the Amazon, unquote, until you start really looking at some of the economic models that have made taking these resources out so profitable.
Now, if it isn't evident by the end of this episode or by the time you read, you know, the National Geographic issue, what is at stake when we consider the peril that the Amazon is facing?
We lose the world's largest rainforest. We lose the world's largest single collection of species and plants and trees. We lose 14,000 years of history, but I think it's also what we bring, which is we bring a pernicious ripple effect onto the climate of the entire planet. Many of us have heard the expression, the Amazon is the lungs of the world. As I said before, it's so much more complicated and even more important than that. It is the nursery of the world, if you want. And what is lost if you kill the world's nursery and the world's single most productive source of biodiversity in plants and animals? This is a question for scientists who study this all the time. And the main thing I came away with is the enormity of the question itself.
Cynthia Gorney is a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine and the former Washington Post reporter and its South American bureau chief. She is also a professor emerita at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California
at Berkeley. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us on what is my first, but for you, another trip through the Amazon.
Thank you very much, Molly.
You can read about the scientists Cynthia and other reporters met and, of course, see amazing photos and maps in the October 2024 special issue of National Geographic devoted to the Amazon. This show is thanks to senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley. And also a special thanks to engineers Kathleen Conti at CDM Studios in New York and Keith Hernandez at the University of California, Berkeley Language Center. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that studies life in all its complexity. And a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters. This piece of music is by João Campos Silva. Other original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science, looking at the challenge and the hope for one of the world's critical ecosystems, is called Amazing Amazonia.
From the creators of the popular science show with millions of YouTube subscribers comes the Minute Earth podcast. Every episode of the show dives deep into a science question you might not even know you had. But once you hear the answer, you'll want to share it with everyone you know. Why do rivers curve? Why did the T-Rex have such tiny arms? And why do so many more kids need glasses now than they used to? Spoiler alert, it isn't screen time. Our team of scientists digs into the research and breaks it down into a short, entertaining explanation, jam-packed with science facts and terrible puns. Subscribe to Minute Earth wherever you like to listen.
Tech moves fast, so keep pace with the Daily Crunch podcast from TechCrunch. With new episodes every day, this podcast will give you a quick overview on everything you need and should know about startups, new tech, regulations, and more. Listen to TechCrunch Daily Crunch now, wherever you get your podcasts. That's TechCrunch Daily Crunch, wherever you get your podcasts.